I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Beer people love to talk about how the beverage they care about so much has brought the same kind of sentiment with other human beings. We're often finding ways that malt, barley, hops, and yeast have given us another figurative ingredient: friends. For those of us who think about beer too much, it's always a treat to find like-minded others wherever we go. In June, I found myself in downtown Madrid while staying in the city as part of a short media tour hosted by Mao San Miguel. I wanted to find some local craft beer, and Google led me to B Beer Craft Beer and Cheeses, a small bottle shop with brands from around Spain, most notably the namesake brewery of the business. It was there I wound up chatting with owner Xavier Losada, learning about what led him to open a craft-focused store in a market where that kind of beer still feels a little new. Xavier has a curiosity to create something new that wouldn't feel too out of place in an American market, and he's working to change the mentality of locals, not just tourists like me who wander into a welcoming bar that feels like home. These kinds of conversations, where there's an international insight to trends or interests we may take for granted stateside, can be so valuable. They're often highlighted in the conversations that my colleague Matthew Curtis hosts here on the podcast. It's a time to meet others who are watching what's happening in beer with a new perspective and better grasp all the changes taking place as craft beer becomes increasingly important around the globe. I heard all that from Xavier, who also actively watches the boundaries of flavor as he creates new brands to serve under the B Beer banner. Want to know more about all the things happening in a place we don't often think about when it comes to craft beer? Stay tuned in. This is Xavier Losada of B Beer. Listen in. Great. So thank you very much for joining for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
Of course. It was serendipitous being able to run into you to kind of learn a little bit about what you're doing with your store. Maybe just to paint a picture for listeners who maybe have not been to Madrid before. If you wouldn't mind, maybe just kind of giving a general idea of, so you guys with your beer store, you've been around for a few years, sharing, you know, what the Madrid or the Spanish beer drinker is and what you guys hoped to kind of push them toward in terms of what you're trying to do with your store and get people to think about beer in a different way.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation. And well, before that, I want to like very quickly tell you about, we are from Venezuela, and I'm a chemical engineer and worked 11 years in a brewery. And it's important, like, for me to say that because that's a part of my background and that's defining the, like, how I prepare beer right now and how I'm building this little business, like, you know, from the base, right? And, well, when we arrived to Spain, it was 2015, the craft beer movement was starting to grow. You know, you could see like maybe 10 breweries, maybe 5 were doing amazing product. Like, you know, like you can make a picture out of that. And compared with the States, that's a joke, you know? It's like, it's huge. I think you have like 13% of the market share. I don't know how much you have right now.
That's about it.
And right now, it's in Spain, it's between 3% and 5%. It's like starting to grow. So we start tasting products and you could find like really nice product, but really terrible off product too. So we start getting into it and getting into the business. We open the store and it's amazing how in 2 years right now you can, there are hundreds of breweries and dozens are making really good product. Yet, it's not easy to find craft beer places to drink the beer, right? They're starting to grow in Barcelona, for instance. They have a lot of craft beer bars. Here in Madrid, still are like, maybe we are one of 10 or 20 right now. Mm-hmm. And Madrid is like, it's a big city and have a lot of tourism. So when we opened the store, maybe 80% of our clients were tourists. And right now I can tell that maybe 50%, you know, it's like the Spanish drinker is getting into it. It's like you can see more and more Spanish, like learning. As you say before, like you have people that know a lot about, you know, around, like can come from the States, as you can come from Belgium. So there's a like a huge wave of knowledge and different products from around the world. And Spanish is like getting like that knowledge and understanding and getting into it. And Spaniards are guys that know a lot about living well, you know? Mm-hmm. They know good wine, they know good sausages, good meat, good, and they're starting to know good beer, but they actually want to.
And that, I think that that presents a really interesting situation for you. So from where you started to where you are, a difference of about 30%. So you said maybe 80% were tourists.
Yeah.
Now that's maybe 50-ish percent. To get that many Spaniards interested in a different kind of beer, especially for people who are very interested and feel connected to the things that they eat and drink, how do you change their minds in terms of what you do as a store owner, as someone who also makes beer?
Well, first, when they cross that door, they already want that to change their mind. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like...
Is there a reason why you think that exists now, that, that Spaniards would want to change their mind?
Yeah, because once when we study like the profile, like how are the people that drink craft beer, we didn't discover, like we realized that wine people is like the best market to convert into beer, because they taste the wine, you know, they value how they drink the wine, at which temperature is it served, where is it from, what's the grape, you know. So who is the vineyard, you know, where is it from. So it's quite the same with the beer. Right now when you open a beer, you want to know who's behind the beer, what has the beer to offer you, which pairing is nice with that beer. So it's quite easy. If you know, it's that's a perfect market. Mm-hmm. And yeah, totally. I think they're open to know new things. Then especially the last years, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. And once they try a flight, you know, once you have like a chance to sit and try an IPA, a lambic, a double, a stout, a lager, and an IPA, and like you have everything in front of you and try different stuff, almost immediately you say, okay, there's something here like I'm missing, and you're into it. Mm-hmm. I think it's happened to me a lot. I don't offer wine, for instance, and neither cider. I know this sounds kind of crazy, because almost every bar has a cider option or a wine option. I have meat, but it's like they're hidden. And when people say like, okay, I want a beer, but my wife or my partner or whatever doesn't drink beer, do you have anything else? The first thing I do is like grab what you usually like. Okay, I like cider. Okay, so I always have a lambic or a sourish beer on tap. So I give it like a sip. Okay, try this. Let's see. And of course, sometimes there's like, okay, I have meat. But a lot of times it's like, wow, I want that. And people start like looking beer in a different way.
Mm-hmm. The part of that, I think, is very common also in the US, where being able to present something new to somebody is though it acts as that gateway. It's that thing that gets them to think about something a little differently. I'm curious though, in regard to the way that maybe wine drinkers in Spain might be a little bit more open to trying beer or thinking about beer in a different way. Is there something that you think exists or the way that you talk to them that encourages that kind of attitude that helps Spanish wine drinkers be a little bit more open to, okay, well, I've always drank wine, but maybe beer is something for me too?
I think that first, like, having totally different beers on tap helps a lot, because you have a tool to talk, to speak with them. Like, of course, you need to... One of the things I say to them is like, okay, you didn't like maybe this, but I have something in bottle. And if you don't like it, it's on me. You know, like, don't be scared. It's like, I think I can find something for you. I try to read, you know, that's very, I don't know, getting into deep, or I try to decipher mm-hmm. what they usually like. And then, okay, let me offer you this beer and see what you think. And yeah, I've been in this situation to like, okay, if you don't like it, I pay for it. Don't even worry. I don't want them to feel like you have to drink craft beer. I think that's not a good attitude towards this. It's more like, you have 7 taps here right now, you can try. If you don't like it, don't worry. It's more a little bit like that. Without pushing. You're pushing, but without pushing. It's like, okay, let me do. And if you don't like it, I have another option. The tasting is a really good way. Well, you in the States know that the tasting is a really good way to get into different beers. So I recommend, like, okay, have the tasting between the three of you and let me know what you like, what you don't like. And sometimes with the people that are very into wine, if I have the chance to talk a little bit more with them, I try to tell them stories about certain beers, like Trappist or like Lambics, you know, and when you get their attention, they want to know what's the taste behind that. And that usually works too. But I don't see it like, it's more fun than a job, you know? It's like, okay, let me talk to you, let's see, da-da-da. It's not like I have to convert you into the religion of craft beer, you know?
That's a very interesting point, because in the U.S., there are most certainly people who have that very specific viewpoint. That's not reflective of everybody, but there are definitely people who see that people should be drinking craft beer because X, Y, or Z, you know, it offers them more flavor or connects to their community or something like that. Why is it that you're not concerned with that?
Well, first, because I think that because I worked 11 years in an industrial brewery, so I've been, long in behind the monsters, you know, like
people can't see it, but there's quotations around that.
Because actually I don't see them as monsters. I know that there are like difference in some of them, you know, in terms of how they see the product. And
how did it be, having those, that kind of role, being a part of a larger international company, how did that change your view? What did it do for you, the way that you viewed what was going on?
Well, because there's like a lot of guys that are like very quality aim, but I'm talking about my experience. I learned a lot about quality. It's like, even when they are, I mean, the most difficult beer to brew is a good lager. Every simple defect, any single effect, you will taste it, you will smell it. So it is a simple beer somehow, you know. It's like, okay, you know what you need to achieve, but it's you need to be really quality driven if you want to brew it right, millions of hectoliters, like year per year. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. It's like, I learned a lot about quality. I learned a lot about systems, you know, how to, can you do something exactly the same way once, like one time, two times, three times, if you go to another job in the same company, how you're gonna do your best and keeping the quality. It's like, and the other thing is like, I learned in Venezuela, for like, it's very important, because in Venezuela we needed to achieve certain optimizations, cost reductions, raw materials reduction, that the rest of the world doesn't need to do right now. But Venezuela, because right now it's like in a terrible, awful moment, we needed to do that like from 10 years. Yeah, I started doing that almost 10 years ago.
What were some of those changes that, well, or like, enhancements that you were trying
to look at? Like, how can you produce the same beer, but you need to reduce like the water consumption? That is a must, because you have several issues with water in Caracas, for instance, or in the entire country. How can you achieve the same bitterness and taste with the hops, but like using the minimum amount of hops? So at which temperature, in what part of the process? So it's, for me, it's like, industry has a lot of like great points. The technology we use today, in every brewer use technology that is there because of the industry. Mm-hmm. They develop it. So of course it has like the bag. It's like, once you want to have the entire market yourself, that's where, okay, come on, like but I'm here to produce different beers. I don't want to be the next InBev, you know. I don't want to be like huge. I'm here to produce beers like as you taste today, a honey ale with basil and orange peel, which is really specific. It's, as you try, it's really good quality, really good beer, but it's not massive. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy that. I'm an artist. I write music. I'm a composer. And for me, this is the best in the middle, the midpoint I ever found between playing piano and being a chemical engineer. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's there. It's like, it's in producing these beers. And yeah, I think beer right now, it's like, I have a lot to thank to the industry and a lot to thank to the craft beer movement. You know, it's like, I think both has great things to use.
So in the US, I think that when you talk about things like finding efficiencies,
yeah,
or trying to find the way to, you know, reduce water, but also with hops, use the least amount of hops to get the same exact kind of thing, people see that as a bad thing. That finding, and again, this is on such a large scale for the companies that do this, that it is quite literally, you know, the way that they have to do it in order to, you know, whether it's maximize profit share, blah, 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 but still to produce the volume that they're doing, that's what happens to happen. So I think it comes with baggage unto itself that it's seen as a bad thing. The way that you're describing it is the opposite. So I'm curious if maybe you could elaborate a little bit more the way that you see it as a good thing that has led you to the point where you can look at these more intimate, thoughtful beers that you're, that you've made and that you think about now.
Okay, first, it's like, as I said before, it's like, there are probably a lot of craft beer brewers doing that, you know, like, how can I, because we are all more earth aware, you know, more green. We're trying to live more green lives, if that makes some sense to
Absolutely.
Say it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, like, I learned it from the industry, and now I'm getting into the craft beer. I'm sure that I'm totally aware, like, a lot of craft beers, like, I'm thinking in how can I optimize this brewery or this process or this beer. But in Venezuela's case, it's the mix of your industry. You have a lot of laws that are like, okay, you have to take care of this, your residual waters, your consumption. But you have to add to that that in Venezuela, it was very hard to find malt, very hard to find hops, very hard to find water. So it was like from out of need, out of, okay, we need to brew, but they are like attaching our hands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of missing translation with the part where you say that.
Oh, it was a case where, beer, like, yeah. So it sounded like the way that you think about the idea of efficiency now has translated not just from, okay, so we have to maximize what we have to create it, but it's taught you a way to think about. So, for example, you mentioned the honey ale.
Yeah.
So what are the ways that I can use certain ingredients to the best of their abilities to hit this very specific flavor aspect that I think is going to work?
Because I think that one of the things they start missing with the whole huge volume, you know, selling is flavor. I think that's the whole maybe war between brewers is about flavor. And I agree that when they try to, like, to get to huge, like, bigger market, it's like, if you can make one tank, like, with the 21, I don't know, millions of liters, if you can do that, you will do that. So you only turn the heat once, and then you recall only one tank. Of course, that's gonna be more efficient. But if you want, I have this joke with some clients. I say, well, I have a gluten-free beer without gas, and it's organic and low alcohol, no alcohol, and I give them water, you know. It's like if you wanna try to have everyone drinking your beer, I think that's a mistake. It's like there's a beer for different occasions, for totally different markets, and that's what I'm aiming right now. It's like, I don't want to brew a beer that's for the entire world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I will place a discussion there. It's like, these guys are trying to, all the huge, like the biggest guys are trying to make one beer, the most, you know, like if everybody drink that one, perfect. Because I don't have to change anything in the process. I just brew once and everybody drinks. I think that's an exaggeration. You know, that's where a lot of people went mad. Like, okay, where is this flavor? I don't like that.
You think it's natural for people to say, okay, I like this beer, but not this beer. This beer's okay, but man, this beer's really great. And that's the way that it should be.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, if you are in an island in the Caribbean and you have the sun on you and you take a bath and go out and you have your entire mouth like full of salt, it's like, okay, you can ask for a lager and that's it, you know, and it's okay. But if you are in a restaurant, like having a huge, like a meat, like with asparagus, I don't know, it's like, okay, I want to, I don't know, maybe a good stout with that. It's for every occasion. And the other thing, of course, is like what it's has like a huge value in the craft beer. It's like if you keep it a little bit contained, like family business or like a city business, is this the story behind. And that's a lot of breweries start to lose their story behind because they are massive. And that's something that's beautiful, I think. Like the story behind every beer. Even with the big, the thing is that with the big, you tell one story. You know? It's like, okay, one story. And maybe it's a great story. But with the small, it's like we can be talking about 20 different stories in a seat in beer, you know, on a craft beer bar. Like, okay, now we're trying this Trappist, Spencer, like stout. Well, it's the first stout from any Trappist. That's very interesting. Like, you start talking about these stories here. And then you try that one of my beers and we talk about how it was designed. So that's another thing that led you this craft beer movement. It's like bunch of stories. And that's sort of life about. No? Yeah.
I realized that we hadn't explicitly said the company that you worked for in Venezuela. Totally, yeah, what was the company?
B Beer Madrid.
Yeah. I'm sorry. The company that you'd worked for in Venezuela.
Sorry, in Venezuela. Yes. Polar.
Okay, yes. Yeah. And B Beer is the bottle shop and brewery that you have in Madrid. I was going to connect those two, so you did the work for me. But in terms, so having come from that giant conglomerate,
yeah,
and like you were saying, thinking about things, storytelling, especially family, of which your current business is very much a family business.
Totally, yeah.
What were some of the things that you learned from working in that larger environment that helped you kind of create the way that you wanted your current business to function and how you wanted that to be something for people to connect to?
Well, but first, it's like actually they are a family business, like huge success family business, and they are one of the most committed families to Venezuela right now. They are like millionaire guys that they are not leaving Venezuela. They are there working every day for a better Venezuela, which is amazing. And I learned a lot about the story there because you connect to that. You connect to, if you know the owner.
What was it about your experience there that made you feel so connected to what
that's
was going
right. on? That's it was, you can feel when you're in a family business, even when it's huge.
Was there something that was going on that, or just the experience of working there, your interaction with other coworkers that yeah. made you feel like you were part of the family?
It's like they let you grow with the business. It's mm-hmm. like I design procedures. I work I work a lot with the ingredients of the beer. I made like tons of proposals, like how to improve it, and they were very open to improve, very open to whatever any worker at any level will say, and that left in me like this feeling of like I want that, you know, I want to start that. I want to start a business where everybody is family, everyone is family, and we can grow together, you know, like they always like has this, like, you need to listen to your client. That's one of the most important things you have, you know, like your client. It's the most important thing you have. Mm-hmm. It's like you have your coworkers and your client. It's like if you preserve both, if you can work towards both, it's like it's a win-win. And actually that I learned that there. It's like we always speaking with clients, what you think, what you like, what you don't like. Sometimes I'd even tell them like, oh, I'm thinking about this, what you think, you know?
When you say clients in that regard, are you talking about retailers who sell the beer or customers who buy the beer?
Well, I would say that in I would say that everybody, because they say like even my wife, which is my partner, is my client too. You know,
it's like very true. Absolutely.
So it's like clients, suppliers, it's customers, it's coworkers. It's like we are very open. You know, we are actually, we are very, like, there's no secret behind Beer, you know? Mm-hmm. You can cross the door, you can talk to me, to my wife, to Dennis, to whoever, and you will see, like, we are very open. We're very open in terms of what we're doing right now, what we want to do, like, where are we right now in this point of the business. And people is very thankful, you know, people is like connect with that, you know, and we have like really great reviews in like TripAdvisor or Google. And I think that's part of that connection with our clients. Yeah. And we do the same with the suppliers. Even when I have my own beer, I want to have beers from other breweries, like always have them all there. Like if you have a good beer, you are not scared of having like near Wefletteren or I don't know, Founders or.
So for example, the right now when I stopped into the store, you had two of your beers on tap,
yeah,
amongst seven taps.
Yeah.
You had Founders,
yeah,
which is certainly internationally known. You had St. Bernardus, internationally known.
Yeah.
These are beers that a lot of people aspire to, brewers that they aspire to be,
yeah,
that they want that kind of level of, yeah, attention and quality and, yeah, and all the other things that come along with it. And so it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, having that kind of balance,
yeah,
should exist, and it also maybe pushes you a little bit too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it compares you. And one of the things I want to do with, I'm doing with Beer and wanted to keep it that way is like, if I want to brew the, like, I don't know how to say this, but I'm going to say it. If you want to brew like the perfect lager, there are a few that are already brewing the perfect lager. If you want to do a perfect West Coast IPA, you already have that. So what I'm trying to do is like try to find those beers and have it in Beer. And try to brew what I'm not finding.
How do you find those beers in Spain?
There are a lot of suppliers. And I don't import anything. So I don't have the volume to bring stuff from the States.
Not even to... to maybe sell, but just to find that inspiration. So when you're saying that you want to find the best of whatever that style of beer,
yeah,
is, to make sure that either you can work toward being better or make sure that you're doing something different because,
yeah,
something perfect already exists. How are those things existing here? How do you find those in a country that people might not otherwise think of as a beer country?
Well, actually, as the market is growing, there are suppliers appearing, like, it's maybe every month, I'm not gonna say every week, but every month a new supplier appears. Mm-hmm. And every month you can see new American beers here. Of course, from Belgium you have a huge offer.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we can find really interesting stuff from Estonia, for instance, from, of course, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and even New Zealand. I've been buying some New Zealand stuff. Of course, it's impossible to have the entire, you know, the entire view. I think that happens with you too. Like, you have a few samples of Belgian beer or Danish beer, you know, and even Spanish, probably, because it's not easy. Like, okay, let's import from everybody. And the biggest, in terms of ranking, like, I don't want to upset anyone with this interview, but I, for instance, Cigar City is like I've tried a really good product. I think I talk to you about the Marshall Zukov rum and bourbon barrel age, which was like incredible. But that's like a gift someone brought me, not something that I can find in a supplier. So it's not easy. You have more options like every month, but there are like beers, you know, that are so demanded that it's impossible even for you. Like, I want this right now. And no, you have to share it. How would you say that?
You have to know a guy who knows a guy.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Well, so you raise a really good point of curiosity for me. Places like Estonia or New Zealand or Spain, who are the breweries that you've found that have been catching your attention? I couldn't tell you anybody from Estonia. Okay. So I'm fascinated by what you think would be stuff that is really kind of doing well.
Yeah, the first thing I have to say is that I didn't found any brewery from Estonia, New Zealand, because there was a supplier that took the chance, like to, okay, I found this product and I'm bringing it to Madrid.
Yeah.
So this, I don't know to pronounce these names, but Eggwire from New Zealand, for instance, is quite good. Mm. Pohjala from Estonia is really good. The Danish, you already know the Danish. Mm. You know Evil Twin, you know Mikkeller, you know Ama, probably. Mm. Hornbeer.
What are the styles of beer that these brewers are making?
I don't know. Right now, like, I try this Decadence beer. It's a rum barrel aged stout, which
is Decadence. Okay.
But I can't pronounce the name of the brewery. It's an Estonian brewery.
Estonian. Okay.
Yeah. But you check for that Decadence with K.
Mm-hmm.
Rum barrel aged, 14% alcohol.
What stout. Is it that struck you so much about that beer?
Well, it actually it connect me a lot with the Marshall Zukov. A lot of common. It's creamy and the raw, you know that, I think we talk about this today too. And when you oak age like with rum barrel, it's quite difficult. It's like I've tried a lot of bad attempts of rum barrel age, and these two are like two of the best I ever try. And they give like this subtle note from rum. We are in Venezuela. We are very toward rum, and even when I'm not a guy that drinks a lot of rum myself, I can tell like, okay, there's something really interesting behind this. And it was about how round it is, even when it has 14% alcohol, even when it has the rum barrel aging, it was very smooth, you know, very creamy. You have to, yeah, you should try it. I think I have a bottle in the store if you want to try it.
Open invitation.
Yeah.
So the connection to that, and I don't know if this is something that you're actively thinking about. So that's a beer that you love, that you found that has something wholly unique. Is that something that you try to then, not replicate, but find ways to impart in the beers that you make for beer? In order to try to offer that kind of experience to others?
Yeah, of course. Of course, you try to learn from the best all the time. Well, you try to learn from everyone all the time. And yeah, I don't want to copy beers, but of course, you identify what's working
in
a beer.
It's the highest imitation of flattery, right? It's fun.
It's like you try the beer and you say, wow, this is amazing. And you try to connect, okay, what's happening in this beer? And what is so good. And then what I do is like, okay, I like this beer. What if I have to say that what can I improve or what can I twist?
Mm-hmm.
Like keeping this amazing experience, what is the twist that I can say like, wow, now it's different and it's equally good.
Which I think, to be fair, is the way that a lot of brewers think about their beers, that they find something that they love and that inspires them.
Yeah.
And that's not copying or stealing so much as it's you're pulling from the things that you find most enjoyable to put your own individual twist on it.
That's right. And that's what we do with music. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when you write a song, that's what you do. It's like, okay, I'm a fan of Led Zeppelin. But if I want to do a new song, I can repeat again and again and again, Stairway to Heaven. It's like, you need to...
It's been done.
You need to give it a twist. And if you want to listen to Stairway to Heaven, put Stairway to Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the point I'm trying to make. I think that's exactly the same point I tried to do in beer. It's like, I don't want to brew a story to heaven because it's someone already brewed that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to like digest that and try to do something nice.
GBH is underwritten in part by Brewery Omegang out of Cooperstown, New York, a 20-year-old pioneer of Belgian brewing in America and home to the exceptional outdoor festival Belgium Comes to Cooperstown, which returns on August 3rd and 4th this year and features Belgian and Belgian-inspired breweries from around the world. GBH will be there this year leading a series of discussions on the state of Belgian beer, what it means to the people who make and drink it, and what it is about Belgian beer that seems to continuously inspire generations of brewers in the US and around the world. In the run-up to the festival, we're publishing a series of stories exploring these topics called Message in a Bottle, highlighting the influence of the Belgian brewing philosophy on the contemporary American scene. You can still get tickets at omegang.com. That's omegang.com. GBH is also underwritten in part by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. With New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and sour ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in the early foundational chapters. These are stories about how these beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with for our Coming to America series. Guinness began brewing, and never stopped, at St. James Gate in Dublin in 1759, and has been shipping beer to America since 1817. And recently, they celebrated their distribution to the US with their 200th anniversary export stout. Coming to America stories highlight the iconic and upstart international brands that are making their way in America in the age of local. And of course, we're also supported by The Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Co., Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The 5 Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, and Boundary Brewing in Belfast. In the US, we have The Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Common House Ale Works in South Carolina, Acusta Brewing in North Carolina, The Beer Cellar in Belmont, Massachusetts, and Daredevil Brewing in Indianapolis. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa. They all support us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. So let's take that then and maybe talk about some of the beers that you've made.
Yeah.
Of the ones that I've had today, so there was a honey ale, there was an IPA with pineapple, a double IPA with mustard seed.
Yeah.
When you are experiencing new beers and trying to think of ways that you might put your own individual spin on it, how and why are you doing that for the customers that come in to be beer here in Madrid? What are the ways that you think that you need to or want to do them in a successful way to get people interested?
That's actually a good question, because if I want to do nothing about it, I think it's fair, and maybe it works too, right? It's like, okay, you can have a band of covers, mm-hmm. and you're gonna be hired for weddings, and you're gonna be hired for, you know, it's gonna
you can make a living off of it
if you do it right. No, I am being serious. It's,
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It's like I know a lot of talented friends, musicians that make a living out of that, and they enjoy it, and I think that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
If you enjoy it and you can make a living out of it, it's perfect. Well, and it's legal.
True.
And so that's the thing. I think it's a part of my soul that it has this art point of view and things, and I want the beers to be part of the art, you know. And of course with the clients, they are like, it's interesting because there are people like with one of the others we have is the brown ale spicy and smoked. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how people can identify that, okay, this is something different, you know. Even people that's not really into craft beer try it and say, okay, there's something happening here.
And to be fair, I'm really into craft beer, and that was definitely different for me when I got to try it. That was wholly unique, and that it was a brown ale that had both a smoke and a pepper component to it. Yep. Of which I don't know if I had it in that specific way ale before.
Yeah.
Presenting that kind of new experience that you're talking about.
So I think people, if it's good quality, people, it's thankful with that. It's like, okay, I want to come back and see what's next, you know?
Hmm.
There's a wasabi lager next, if you're wondering.
yeah, and you had mentioned that as well. So I'm, how did you come to try to make a wasabi lager?
Well, when I tried to mix a lot of stuff, it's like, I don't know who's, when I'm into the craft beer stuff, I haven't read enough, but I think in England there were like these taverners or these guys from bars that had their own mix of beers. Like, okay, let's go to Xavier's bar where he mixes the San Bernardos in the same glass. The San Bernardos with the wheat beer, with the lambic, with the stout. And it's fucking incredible.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of in that, like, nowadays it's like, no, don't do that, you know, that, and actually, sometimes I actually do that, you know, like, what happened, if I find a beer, it's like, I tap a honey ale, and I see, like, oh, this is maybe too sweet, and lacks a little bit of hops, I try, and put a little bit of the IPA, and see what happened, you know, and so just I'm doing the same thing with the spices.
As someone who creates beers, how does that make you feel? When something comes out not what you expected, and oh, I need to mix it with something else to make it just so.
Well, I'm expecting that doesn't happen.
One always hopes, okay. Right?
well, that's actually until now, it's not my experience. I don't know. The only thing I hope not to do is like, put it on it a lot of hops so it tastes different.
Mm.
You know, like, but it's a tough decision. If like what you do is like, if it's a good beer in terms of quality but doesn't have the taste you want it, I don't know.
So let's bring it back to that wasabi lager. Yeah. How is it that you were thinking about how to use that kind of ingredient to make it just so?
The same thing with the beers that sometimes I mix things at bar. I start to do that with spices. It's like when I go and have dinner in a fancy restaurant or I go to a market and they have a lot of spices, I try to think, like, I smell things and I try to think all the time, how does it work in beer? Everything. Even, you know, I know that Mikel...
Oh, so you do that too, huh?
That's right. So I know this guy. I don't know if Mikel put a lot of hamburgers in. Mm. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything. But, I mean, you need to ask... Well, not everybody, but I ask myself, like, okay, what happened if I put this... And if I put this in a beer, what would be the best style for that beer? And if there's a style, which malts, which hops? And that's sort of what I do. with, for instance, for me, the first, my first recipe was the mustard seeds IPA. And it was like, just like that. Like, I, in my entire life, I like mustard. And one day I thought like, I think that there are hops that had a lot to do with mustard seeds. So that's when I decided like, okay, I want to try an IPA in mustard seeds. Of course, your next question is which hops do you use? But it, yeah, it all started that way. And then you have to figure out where will it work. Will it work like boiling or fermentation or dry hopping?
To clarify, did you mean Mozart, the composer?
Yeah.
Symphony number 6?
Okay.
Is that what you were talking about as your inspiration for that beer? No. Or am I making that up completely out of the air? That's fine. I just wanted to make sure I understood.
No, it's okay, because my English, like...
Oh, no.
I know. When I say mustard, people say mustard.
I'm taking the composer from you, and I'm just
placing it. No, that's great. That's amazing, because I have a new story. A new story behind the beer.
You're welcome. Monster, number 6. Am I getting it right now? Am I close?
No. You got lost.
No.
No, that was as simple as the mustard seeds in beer.
Mustard seeds. I'm sorry, that's on me. Mustard
this
seeds.
This was the crazy
you're talking. Word. You're talking about the double IPA. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Mustard seeds. Okay. Got it.
I'm so sorry for
no,
that.
No, that's me. Lost
so
in translation.
So my mother language is Spanish. This is really important.
You are doing great. You're doing great.
But I will take that symphony.
I'm doing all the thematic work for you.
Yeah,
at this
great.
Point, right?
Thank you. That's a better concept than this mustard seeds.
Okay, so the mustard seeds, yes, of which I don't think people would imagine as an ingredient you put in beer. So why was that something that needed?
No,
to go
as
in
I
your
told,
beer?
As I told you, it's like because like thinking about how certain ingredients work with beer, mm-hmm. It was like okay. The mustard. I want to use the mustard. I think it pair really well with hops. So that's what I decided that probably an IPA will work with that. Mm. And then we like start searching for hops and Cascade was like the perfect match. So, and if you want to know like everything, it's like if you put the mustard in boiling, it will taste like soup. So don't do that.
So the end game of that is also convincing people that they should drink a beer that has mustard
seeds
in it.
That's really interesting. Because when you say it, people like, this is an Imperial IPA with Mozart 6 in it. People like, I don't know, they think it's a hamburger or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Or a hot dog. It's like, people put like a face like, whoa. And it doesn't taste like that. It's like... It tastes like a, well, you try it today. It's like a West Coast IPA, mm-hmm. but with this mustard seeds notes in it. But you, if you don't know it has mustard seeds, I think you will say it's the hops.
Something from the hops.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Which ultimately I imagine as a brewer could be a good thing, that people aren't thinking about it in terms of that particular ingredient, but the way it just tastes to them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, actually that's another of the thing I don't want to do. It's like sometimes they tell you like, okay, this is a grapefruit IPA and you have to imagine the grapefruit. You know, it's like okay, think hard because there's grapefruit somewhere. I want to be more straightforward with my beers. It's like honey with basic orange peel, you will find every layer of it. Mm-hmm. The same with the mustard seeds and the brown ale spice and smoke. And with the pineapple juice IPA.
How does a pineapple juice IPA end up in Madrid, Spain? How does that happen?
In terms of what?
The demand, the interest?
Yeah, it's crazy. Actually, it's crazy. It's selling really fast, really well. One of the things that you already... pass through this is like the first thing that anyone ask is for an IPA when they're starting in the craft beer movement. Mm-hmm. So
even here in Spain, if it's a native Spaniard, they're interested in IPA.
Totally. Mm-hmm. It's worth, I don't know why. I don't know what's the psychology behind that. I don't know if it's the first thing that the people that doesn't know about craft beer thinks is different. But it's that it's people like it, I have these 7 tabs and the IPA always is the best seller. Mm-hmm. Always. People, the first thing they ask is IPA. So on that hand it's like it really easy to sell because it's that one of the IPAs on tap, and well, it's quite refreshing because it has like these tropical notes, you know, like pineapple, you connect with being in the beach, and it's a perfect time for that, like from March to September probably, is like from April to September is really, really nice weather to sell the beer, even when it's 7.2% alcohol, but it doesn't taste like. So, yeah, actually, people love it. People like it. Like it. Until now, we've been like really, really good reception with our beers.
What is it in terms of the things that you think you can do if you're making a wasabi lager and a pineapple IPA and a mustard seed IPA? What does that tell you in terms of the things that you can do in the future with beer that you're making for the local market here in Madrid?
Well, actually, I start this sort of beer pairing series project, and in the States will understand me, they will say like the BBPSP and that's it. And what I'm doing is like I'm looking for high-end cuisine like restaurants in Madrid, and I'm starting to design beers for their menu. Actually, the wasabi lager is the first on that series. It's like I start talking with this guy who has two really good Japanese restaurants here in Madrid, and he was really into the idea, and I try his food, and I design for his menu the wasabi lager. So this is what's gonna happen like next, like in with our beers with characters, you know, you saw our brands are like this character from Clue, you know, like cardboard games. Mm-hmm. And so these are not characters, this is like BB repairing series number one, and it's from this Japanese, so we will sell our beer in their place and at BBR, and it's beer designed for your food. So I already have 4 designs. I have right now like 4 potential clients, and it's really, really, really interesting because that fits my interest for different types of food and spices, and how can I put them into a beer and make them work with your food.
So that raises a really interesting point. Do you think that you can do that, or people are receptive to that, this idea of beer with or for food, because the Spanish consumer has done that before? Or is it because the Spanish consumer now accepts beer as something that can be paired with food in that kind of way?
Well, actually, Spaniards are like used to drink a cup of wine with food. So Spaniards know a lot about pairing with food. So they are not close to pairing with food. They are like surprised that you can pair beer with food. So you have already a step taken, you know, like, so it's a great way, and you know that it's a great way to like excuse to have a different beer, because if you have the appropriate food with that beer, you're gonna drink fast, because it's gonna match perfectly. And if you got like a good sommelier, a good like guy attending you and telling you, okay, if you're asking for this dish, you have to try with this beer, people for sure gonna buy it. Because people is used to drinking a cup of wine or a beer with fruit.
It's so ingrained in the process that it just makes sense for people who are eating at out that.
Maybe the first time they will like be surprised, like what, the wasabi lager? You know, it's but they will, they are open to try it. Of course, it's totally different way than only having it at the bar. Because you already have like clients that go for the new stuff. So just tap it and it will start selling, and you'll see. In the restaurant, you need someone to sell it. Like, okay, this is new, you should try it with this and this dishes. But I think it actually, I think it's one of the best ways to start with craft beer. If you are not into it,
is pairing it with food.
Yeah, if you do a good pairing, it's like boom, you know? It's like a blue cheese. It's like one of the most famous pairing, as Garrett Oliver would say. It's like the Stilton with the barley wine. It's like, this is, you know, it's like 2 + 2. It's very easy. Mm. But if you don't like blue cheese and do like barley wines, probably you will say like, whoa, this, there's something interesting is the blue cheese, and either way too. So I think it's an easy way to get people into craft beer, but they have to be a good pairing, because it can do the like the opposite. It's a bad pairing, it's really like disaster.
So which raises the question of, you know, the quote-unquote craft beer in Spain being such a small percentage of the market, 2 to 3% or so. Is that the way that it happens in this country from your perspective? Do you think that the way to grow the idea and the acceptance of craft beer is through food and not just on its own?
Well, actually, I haven't thought about that. Like that.
Can I put you on the spot for that one?
As simple as you just put it. Yeah. And I think it's really a really, really, really interesting way to like to put it like black and white. And yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity there, now that you say it. Hmm. Don't tell mom.
So with that in mind then, how do you go about trying to grow what you're doing with B Beer and the way that you think about beer to trying to enhance what you're offering customers? What is it that you think about when you think about the future of your company?
Well, I think that service has to be like top quality, and we have to keep that. I think that we always want to be part of the process, part of the faces that people see. So we don't want to lose that. I think if we keep ourselves toward like quality driven and always try to offer the best quality from cheeses, from sausages, from beers, of course, I think that's the way in, like the way ahead. It's like, we are not trying to lie no one, you know, like to, okay, let me offer this, but I'm selling this. No, no, this is what I'm offering you. And if you want to take a look, take a look. And I think we think like with my wife, my brother and his wife, it's like, we are totally driven, like we want to sell the best quality, we want to be proud of what we're selling and we're doing, and we want our customers and our co-workers be proud of what we're doing. So I think that's the path, you know, like, let's go there. We are trying to give steps, like growing steps, but we're being very careful, because I don't want to sound stupid, but finding the money is the easy part. The hard part is to do it right, you know. It's like, and then you, if you screw it, you will have nothing. So we want to go ahead, but like really thinking about it and making it one step at a time.
Well, I look forward to hearing about what that one step at a time approach is for you.
Okay.
Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you so much, Brad.
thanks for listening this week. It may have been a slow one for you around the 4th of July holiday, but we've been busy at Good Beer Hunting. Over on the GBH website, we've got the latest from Evan Rail, who explores what the idea of Belgian beer means on a global scale. If a beer tastes Belgian, shows Belgian character, or is even Belgian-inspired, what does that mean to different people? There's also a powerful humanity and hospitality essay from Katie Mugley, who reflects on sexual harassment in the workplace and her experience dealing with and overcoming it. Please take the time to read, consider, and reflect on her words, and thanks to Katie for sharing them. Among our latest sightlines, you can read how Citra hops have become synonymous with American craft beer, and lastly, the fervent few talk consumption, moderation, and strategies for a healthy lifestyle. How are they staying safe and taking care of themselves? Thanks to everyone who shared their insight. If you want to join the fun and become part of the Fervent Few, check out goodbeerhunting.com/fervent few. As part of the community, you get access to a host of perks in addition to sharing your voice with those of us on the GBH editorial team. We're so thankful for the support, encouragement, and inspiration of the Fervent Few and what they offer beer lovers too. Thanks to all our readers and listeners who make Good Beer Hunting a part of their routine. That's it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.